Delighted to be with you again, and particularly excited about the guest today. We have a gentleman that, for many of us, there's mysteries of things going on. There's so much, and how do you find someone that's taken the time to do in-depth and prolonged independent research? Well, get ready for a treat on some of the most important topics of our times. The gentleman today who's our guest, we're delighted to have Philip Gardner. And Philip has been described variously as, get this, the Antichrist, the devil incarnate, a seeker after truth, shocking, the most interesting interviewee ever, challenging, controversial, the new Salman Rushdie, and he was even banned from the United Arab Emirates. Now, Philip has acted as an advisor to various authors and radio programs regarding mythology and history, as well as having ghostwritten many articles for various magazines. Kind of a regular guy in many ways. He's married with two children, lives in the heart of Robin Hood country in England, good old Sherwood Forest. He has a master's degree in strategic marketing and 9 diplomas ranging from personal management through to holistic medicine and the craft of etymology. And although he's been asked on numerous occasions to become a member of several institutions or societies, Philip has strictly refused on the grounds of independence, seeking membership of certain organizations as being overly influential on his research and understanding that the truths of mankind. To do this, he needs to be independent. And so he believes that some of the authors and researchers who have been led into membership of institutions or society may be influenced and may be of questionable authority. So his background, too, is in the history of propaganda and the ancient and ongoing manipulation of mankind. And this stuff tells him that such things do indeed occur. So he has joined, upon being requested, a couple of what are known as secret societies in order to find out what was actually happening inside. This is amazing. So the conclusions of these journalistic forays appear in his books, and of course he is no longer a member of any organization. So get ready, folks. There's just so much. We're blessed to have this wonderful gentleman with us. Philip, welcome to Advanced Living.
Thank you very much for having me. What a build-up.
Oh, well, I'm just honored. I've done a little review of the DVD about your secret societies, and that's compelling. And then there's other work that you've done, finding the Ark of the Covenant, I mean, the stuff with Mary, the Shroud. Wow, I can't wait. Tell me, what got you started, for instance, on the trail of the Ark?
Well, I can give you the long story or the short story, but I'll try and give you a medium-term one. What got me started in all this? What got me started in all this in the real beginning were a couple of gentlemen that I knew very early on in my working career who were involved in quite opposite things. One was in a thing called the Sealed Knot, which is an historical society in England where people reenact the Civil War and throw things at each other and get drunk very merrily. And another one was in a thing called the Lord Byron Society, which is, of course, following the mad, bad and great Lord Byron. So poetry and philosophy. So I had two kind of influences. So that's the early on influence in my life. But last year, early last year, what influenced me to go on the trail of the Orc, I was giving a speech in Winchester, England, which is a very Catholic town and remains steadfastly Catholic even during the puritanical upsurge of Protestantism in England. So the cathedral there is still very symbolic in many ways. The Catholics, of course, gave us several things in our history, not all of them good, but some of them are quite good for historians, and that's that they gave us symbolism which we can then read. And so I was in Winchester, and I was basically there to give a speech, but I was spending some time in the cathedral, and I was looking for one of my ancestors, which is a Bishop Stephen Gardiner. And I found a mausoleum with the Ark of the Covenant on one side being carried by Moses and the people of Egypt, of Israel, out of Egypt in front of the Great Pyramids. And this, of course, to anybody who knows symbolism and knows to read the different levels, you would realize that because this isn't biblically correct, it's telling you something much deeper. And so that kind of set off a cascade in my mind of all the things that I already previously knew and got me started on the quest for the Ark.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, because I guess, is it a new book that you have, The Ark, Shroud, and Mary? Or is that...
It's a book and a DVD, so we've done it both ways.
Oh, okay. Well, I know the DVD you did about secret societies, beautifully done. Now, people can look at more information by going to your website, right? Which is gardenersworld.com.
That's it, yep.
Okay, that's www.gardinerseworld.com. Get ready, folks, for just one treat after another of just amazing things that we look at in the complexity of whether it's religious tradition or some conspiracy theory or governmental interventions, a number of things. And Philip has looked into so many of these things and brought forth information to help support us to see through the mist and the clouds of some of the illusions that have been out there. And, of course, that's part of his background in learning about the use of propaganda and of course, how to go around it. So what might you share a little bit more about your quest with the Ark of the Shroud and Mary?
Well, of course, when I first started getting into the Ark, it wasn't... I wasn't really thinking about Mary or the Shroud at all, and so I was really just on a, well, what's this Ark all about, and why is it being portrayed in kind of very Gnostic ways in Winchester and various other places that I then went on to find it. So I kind of gathered around me several hundred books, and I've got a library of about 3,000 here, so I was... deeply buried in books for a long time, and then set off around the world on a preordained travel that I'd worked out that I needed to go and do. And of course, in that research, I was then finding that Mary herself was called the Ark of Fedoris, which means the Ark of the Covenant, because she was the method by which the new covenant was brought to us. She was known as the Lady of Light, the Womb of Light, or the Ark of Light. Very much like the Old Testament Ark carried God, she was to carry the new God, the Jesus. And so that was quite interesting. And then, as I moved on, I found in the etymology, the language, the science of language, that even the sacred Sindon, as it's known, the shroud, is related to the Ark in language, because, of course, it too carried Jesus. And much like the Ark, it was supposedly made by this shining light, this radiation, as Jesus was supposedly resurrected. You can think what you want about, really, the propaganda that's gone up around all of this in building Christianity. But, as I often say, you know, the book, The Ark, the Shroud, and Mary, is the light side of the human mind. It's the wisdom aspect. It's the knowledge-seeking, the quest. And Secret Societies, the book and DVD, which is just out as well, is the dark side. Because one thing for sure the Gnostics told us about is that the mind of man is both light and dark, positive and negative, chaotic and order. And so I split those two elements up into the two books and two DVDs so that you can go for the dark and the light. And the secret societies, if you like, they're ways of transferring this information from one generation to another, whether it be light or dark.
Ah, okay. And the information being about, what, spiritual awakening, or...?
Well, there are two ways. There's the spiritual awakening side, and there is, of course, on the mind manipulation side, those people who wish to take power always take over secret societies or create them, or create cults which develop into secret societies before they then take official power, much like Christianity did. There are those kind of people, but within all of these, there are also the people who pass on what the Sufis term the baraka, which is the essence, the sacred knowledge that man has maintained for a great many years, right from Egypt, if not before, and down through the Essene, and down through Christianity, and then down through alchemical law and into Freemasonry and various other secret societies. That is the baraka, which of course is also related to the term bark, or ark, the bark being the Egyptian ark, and the baraka being the bar, the car, the spirit and soul of Egypt, with Ra, the solar god. So you have the ark there in perfect balance between the spirit and the soul of mankind. As the solar bark of the Egyptians, as the solar bark of the Scandinavians who placed it upon their rock art. It's a very ancient device. And it's to the Sufis, the baraka was even imaged as a boat. So it's a fascinating concept, the baraka. It's an ancient mystical concept. It's something that you attain when you get into an altered state of consciousness, but you must bring wisdom and knowledge to that process, or you will end up in hell, mentally. So it gets quite complex, and that's why it needs breaking down and giving to people in a straightforward language, because for too long now it's been placed in a mist of language in order to evade statements of heresy from the Catholic Church and various others. Well, you know, those times are over, and now it's time to speak these truths to the real world in real language. Hello?
Hello, hello. There was a minor technical glitch there. And Philip, are you back with us? Philip?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. I had a little technical glitch, and I missed a part of what you were saying. But I think that went out to the listeners, so that's important there. They're the ones that need this information most of all, and I'll be reviewing more of the work that you've done. So this balance of the dark and light, this is a very important concept. Because there's a number of people that seem to have a great amount of fear around some of the what are called conspiracy theories or these secret societies, and so I don't know if you can you address a little bit and from your research about how the average person one learn more about these things and then integrate that into their lives as they look at the greater scope of power struggles going on the planet.
Mm. Well, you know, a lot of the time, the issue comes from how we approach it. We can go to these things with a concept that if we're going towards a secret society, we have this vision in our mind that this will be the occult, or this will be something dark and sinister or manipulative. Or we can go towards it like a great many people do towards the Rosicrucians or the Golden Dawn or something similar, with a concept that they wish to find some sacred truth about the divine. The truth is, we need to come to all of this, whoever it is, whether it's Freemasons, Golden Dawn, Rosicrucians, Bilderbergers, whoever it is you want to talk about, you've got to come to it in balance and understand that all of these groups are, first of all, just groups of human beings who are no different to you or I. And so they are themselves dualistic individuals with divided minds that are seeking some sort of balance and some sort of order for themselves, that are seeking control, that are seeking to boost their ego, all a great manner of things that all men and all women suffer from time to time. The truth is that you need to come into it with that concept, with a completely open mind and in balance. And what you'll find, let's pick on the Freemasons, just as an example. The Freemasons are not one group. You cannot go to them and say, you know, do you know worshipful brother so-and-so? Because they may be in a completely different lodge, in a completely different order, totally disassociated with that particular right or even country. They are totally divided in a great many ways, just like the Christians are. Secondly, you can go to the Freemasons and you can expect to maybe find some conspiracy theories that they are trying to control the world. What you'll find is you will find that because they are a group of individuals that do have power. There are people in there that are free, that are lawyers, doctors, priests, politicians. But you will also find that at the local level, at the lodge level, that they are also just local people, local men who are, some of them are charitably inclined, some of them just want to join a boys' club, have a pint, some of them want to improve their business lot. It's just an amalgamation of human beings that have come together. And very often, just like flocks of birds and animals, they come together for protection, for power, for survival. So you've got to come to the really, really balanced viewpoint. And that's what I would advise anybody. Don't go running out and trying to find the conspiracy book. If you do, go and find one that's been written by the actual people that we're talking about, the conspirators, and try to balance it up somehow.
Ah, okay. Then you get it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
Okay. I know you
Absolutely.
Made a...
Well, this is what I tried to do. I tried to get it from the horse's mouth by actually going and speaking to these people, which is what not a lot of conspirators do. They just sit on the internet and and pull together lots of different threads and hope that they come up with some kind of conspiracy. Or actually go and talk to the people, or actually go and infiltrate, change your name, get in there and see how far you can push, what you can find out. I mean, recently I had some meetings with another author, who Tim Wallace Murphy, who Dan Brown used for The Da Vinci Code, and who wrote a book called Roslyn. Very famous author, but also a top Freemason. And so I sat and spoke to him for a couple of days and got to a different level of the Freemason order and what his side of this stuff meant and the real esoteric nature of that, but also found out that that there were connections across Europe and across the world with extremely powerful people. So, you know, both sides seem to be working together sometimes too.
Ah, okay. That's where I guess it makes me a little curious, because I know in watching some of the secret societies thing, you gave a couple of examples, but that quite often when the state or the government in power, they want to stay in power, and they may actually create a secret society just to draw people to them. Can you? Where they can observe some of their adversaries firsthand, because they've started their own group of adversaries. That was a unique thing.
Absolutely beyond all doubt, and that's been going on since man started, since he managed to discover consciousness, I would say. But that's just, use an example, for instance, the Illuminati, that a great many people talk about as being as if they're still around today. And this is a group that's started by a man named Adam Weishaupt in the 18th century, who was a Jesuit priest. Now, the Jesuits have often been called the secret society of the Catholic Church, and it's absolutely true. They are the Gestapo. One of them said to me, "Why do you pick on us so much? Because we've had more martyrs than anybody else." And I said, "You've had more martyrs because you've upset more people." The Illuminati was supposedly anti-Catholic and using Freemasonic methods and means to do its job. In actual fact, it had a confessional. It was set up around Jesuit creeds, and it fed its information back into the Catholic Church. And if you own a football team, the best way of winning is to own both sides. And it's not just secret societies that do this, but the secret services do this. The secret services of our nations, of our governments, do this too. You set up a secret society, you are attracting people that are supposedly against you, and you get confessions out of them, so you know what they're up to. And you can also influence them, so you've got a two-way stream going off with the very opposition, who believe they're in a society completely against you. And the same thing is being done today. Secret societies are set up at universities and at power places around the world by people who want to know what you're up to. My advice to people is don't join anything. Remain independent and be very careful about, if you do find something, who you give that information to.
Ah, okay. Now, the term you mentioned, Illuminati, that we've looked at. Now, could you provide a little more information? Because it appears from what I was seeing that there's a long history of what are called illuminated beings that go back, which sounds a lot different than some sort of people trying to control the world.
Well, there are a great many arguments about this. You can go into the concept that these illuminated ones, these enlightened beings, these shining ones, according to people who are into aliens or maybe altered dimensional beings, other dimensional beings, that these are great aliens or beings that come through portals in order to control us. Very much like the biblical angels or watchers, that Enoch spoke about as well, coming down to control the people and to watch us and to make sure we do as we're told and to even genetically manipulate us. There are other people that see these as ordinary people who had a great countenance of shining because they were great wise people who were led us in the past. And the origins can be discovered right back into Sumeria. The truth, is more difficult than both of those two things, because I'm somebody who actually goes along with what history can tell us and not fill in the gaps with fanciful imagination, such as the Zachariah Sitchin style or Eric von Daniken imagination. I don't necessarily go along with the alien concept of this. To me, what is being spoken of from the text that I've discovered and from the standard history is we're talking about wise people over time that have managed to take control, and then elements of seeped in where they have tried to maintain power. A lot of this, the language spoken about these great shining ones, these illuminated ones, is pure fantasy and fable, but also a lot of it is symbolism. And it's symbolic of the process of the enlightenment, of an inner mystical experience, which for most people is unknowable, and so appears to be incredible and fantastic. People that have this mystical experience, let's say, for instance, Muhammad, who had it and met an angel, Gabriel, or Jibril, then have to translate this stuff for the other people, for the people around them, the information that they are supposedly getting, which is really from their unconscious self. They pass this information on to the people, but then only within a generation that supposed wisdom and knowledge and connection to the divine is stolen by people who then want to use it to take power. And this is where you get issues and problems arising. And so you can actually trace the generative cause of most religions to the mystical enlightenment experience, where you go inside of yourself, where you contact the unconscious self, where you are consciously aware of it, via a process known as the hypnagogic, where you are between awake and asleep. And it's a strange process, and it's one that most religions have tried and succeeded in finding ways of actually getting into that state, getting into that mystical state of connection to the divine. Whether you are a Sufi, which is the mystical element of Islam, where you dance around in circles, whether you beat and flagellate, which is a process to actually make your soul wish to leave the body so that you go into an altered state of consciousness, or whether you meditate or prayer or fast or take drugs. All of these methods have been used throughout time to alter our state of consciousness, to connect to that, what's known, that world of the unconsciousness, which is seen to be below the waves, beneath the sea, where our great ancestors went to, where these shining ones disappeared to in Atlantis, Lemuria, and Thule. In order to connect back to that path, to that shining path, to that element of the divine, they've always tried to do it, and it is a central core to most secret societies. Totally misinterpreted by a great many people.
Wow. I can understand that. Now, you mentioned briefly Atlantis and Lemuria. I don't know if in your research, if you found things that validate that, yes, these were civilizations, or are they stories that have come to give us teaching as Christ spoke in metaphors and in his different ways to teach us through his stories?
Well, there are some elements of our history which none of us can actually state categorically that we know anything about. I don't actually have beliefs because, you know, belief means to love something, and that's a real emotional statement, and that leads you down the road of faith, which leads you down into further belief and then control by other people and concepts. So I don't have those, but my concept or my opinion on Atlantis is that this is a folk memory of some past that may have existed in particular Egypt and other great civilizations, which has then developed over time into stories of a time that was better. How many of us know that our grandparents always say, oh, it was better when I was a kid? And it's the same psychological, even archetypal process that goes off around the world, which is why we find these things all over the world, linked to something that was probably real, and then utilized by people such as Plato, who himself was in a secret society anyway, utilized by people such as that in order to teach something of great worth. The same can be said about people like fabled people such as Arthur and Guinevere, King Arthur, and Robin and Marian, and Solomon and Sheba. The same can be said about these individuals. There may have been some element of historical truth, but it is so far from the stories and fables that we have now that really what we need to see in them is the truth that was hidden into the fable, the teaching. Have we lost you again? Hello?
Oh, Philip. Sorry, just another technical glitch on that. Forgive me, you were explaining a little bit that you don't get into so much believing in things, because that can lead someone astray down a path of belief and faith and then more easily manipulated. Were you saying that Atlantis and Lemuria, as best you could tell, at least in your opinion, are kind of like folk fables or memories?
Yes, the elements of them will be folk memories of some past. I think you probably missed a good few minutes of the later description from the...
Oh, okay. Well, we'll just I'll pick up that on the review, and we'll carry on from there.
Okay.
So when you're, I see it an element in your work that is, to me, very, very much supporting individuals to stay independent, which I think is very powerful. And in your different books, are you kind of illustrating? I'm not familiar with all your works, but can you go into a little bit of some of the themes in different things that you've published so that the listeners get an idea of some of what they can garner from your vast experience and impartiality, which I think is a gem?
I wish I could totally say I'm impartial, but I don't think anybody can actually claim 100% in their life, because we're all influenced by people around us and things that we read. But, you know, our ancestors tell us to do these things, and I try to follow the things that I glean, that I personally believe in. You know, the Bible tells us to test the spirit. Plato himself said, don't believe a word I say, and many of the great Greek philosophers do. And that's how I take them, on their word. Okay, I won't believe a word you say, I'll move on. So that's what I do. I test the spirit. I see if there's any truth in these things. And using all the special devices that you have, whether archaeology, history, textual, all kinds of different things, oral, lots of different methods, even science. And I really started out with a book called The Serpent Grail, which brought two worlds together, if you like. It was the world of reality, of literal things, in as the actual snake, and how the venom of the snake was used as an elixir of life, And then with the work with Gary Osborne in that book, also the mystical element of this stuff, how the concepts of the serpent and... kind of catalyst for me. It went bestseller and it's in about 20-odd different languages now. And then I followed on with Gnosis, The Secrets of Solomon's Temple, which really needed to be done because the mystical world can be an incredibly dangerous one for people to just rush off into. And there is something that our ancestors tell us that we need to be aware of if we're going to go down this road, and that's Gnosis, which is a Greek word for knowledge. Because if you don't have this knowledge and you don't have this balance, you are going to end up in hell because you will take all the baggage with you. And I do not wish anybody to try and attempt altered states of consciousness, because there is absolutely no need whatsoever to do so. You can live a much better life by following certain processes, and these processes are discussed in a number of books. And they are, first of all, discovering who you are. Now that sounds really new age and whimsical, but people say, well, what do you mean by discovering who you are? And one of the easiest ways of understanding it is this. During your entire life, you are collecting cloaks that other people have made and placing them upon yourself. So much so that by the time you get to 30 or 40 years old, you're so weighed down with the cloaks of other people that you can't eat, nobody can see who you are anymore. It's like going and watching a James Bond film. You talk to most of the men that come out of a James Bond film, and they have a sense or feeling that they're now James Bond, and they get in their car and they enact or reenact the James Bond feeling. You know, they'll want to buy Bond gadgets and all different kinds of things. And this has been, these little influences affect us in smaller and bigger ways. So to discover who you are, you need to understand that you aren't any of those things, because James Bond himself wasn't even real, and he was created by a man who was seriously screwed up himself anyway, Ian Fleming, who died of smoking 70 cigarettes a day and drinking 2 bottles of vodka. Because basically he never managed to quite discover who he was and come into terms with that. So you need to find out who you are. Then you need to learn to balance out your life. You need to, as Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas, when you make the male and the female one, when you make the outer and the inner, make the outer like the inner and the inner like the outer, then you have discovered the divine. And this is, I'm paraphrasing Jesus, this is what it's all about. It's all about finding perfect balance within ourselves in order to deal with other people. And the Temple of Solomon is a prime example of that, and a metaphor for how we should live. It is the temple of man, and the divine is in his own mind within the temple. The ark, the connection to God, is in the temple. And you can only get into that place by walking between the pillars. If you walk into one of those pillars, you'll hurt yourself and you will be unbalanced. You can only walk between the pillars in perfect balance. So that's key too. So there's finding yourself and finding balance. And then there is learning the simple system which helps everybody in every element of your life. If you can just take these three words and think about them, and that is strength, which, if you think about your business life, that would be your boss giving you authority or power to do something, or having the money to do something. In your personal life, it's actually having the inner strength to overcome issues and fear. Then the next word is knowledge. In the business life, you must have knowledge about the product and knowledge about your competitors. In personal life, you need to have knowledge of your family and who you are and you know, how to go about life in general. And the third word is will. You must have willpower. Because if you've got strength and knowledge, but you haven't got any willpower, you're just never going to get up off your backside and do anything. And if you have got will and knowledge but no strength, then you're a very knowledgeable but willful person without the authority to do anything. So all those three words have to come in perfect balance, and you have to have all three of them. And this is stuff that basically comes through in my books. This is what we're talking about. This is the light side, the nice, the good, the wise aspect of what our ancestors have been telling us in fables and mythology now for such a long time. And we've all kind of missed a lot of it because we're going in all with preconceived ideas.
All those cloaks that have been put upon us through our years of going through life.
Absolutely.
Huh. Now, I'm curious. This sounds to me like very wise. Now, is a lot about this in that book, The Gnosis?
Yes, it's in. You'll find most of it in Gnosis, and of course, I revisit some of it in The Art of the Shrouded Mirror, because The Art of the Shrouded Mirror is a very esoteric truth, which of course comes from the Greek word eis, which means within. Esoteric means within the self. So these are truths that we already have ourselves. We just need to refine them.
Yes. Now, there's a couple of things that come to mind, and I'm guessing that maybe this is a pathway to something very powerful. The first commandment says, "I'm the Lord thy God, you shall put no other gods before me." And there's a biblical phrase that says, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you." And I'm just wondering how you would blend those with what you're talking about of the strength, the knowledge, and the will.
Well, the words that you've just spoken, of course, are totally true in light of what we've just spoken of. They've been utilized to manipulate people too, and that's the dark side. And so that also, it's also very important to come to those words in balance and not come into them with preconceived concepts. If you come to those words and understand the divine to be what the Gnostics told us it was, and that is not something that you go to church to pay the priest for, not something that you can't contact directly, not something that you have to stand outside and wait for the priest to come out after he's gone in and made his offering and hand over your hard-earned cash, but something that you can find within yourself. And people will say to me, "Well, how do I know if I've contacted the divine?" I'll say, "Well, there's only you can tell that, whether you have contacted this concept of the divine, for whatever you believe that to be. But there is a way of getting closer, if you like, to what it all means, to the oneness, to the nature. And that's actually very, very simple. And we are told it again and again, and that's to trust your intuition. And if you trust your intuition, you will find that you will actually be giving in to something that is beyond human consciousness. Because human consciousness, forgive my language, but it screws everything up. Way too often it screws everything up. So, if you just completely surrender to your own intuition, you are surrendering to something that is as old as the Big Bang. It is a mathematical equation, if you want to see it that way. It is a sacred truth, if you want to see it that way. But it is something that once you do give in to your intuition, you will find that you are, in all humility, giving in to what those biblical writers were talking about as the divine. Mm. Does that explain it?
Yeah, that's a help. Now, I know in my own life, and I don't know if this would apply to any of the listeners out there, I've seen a difference in the choices that I've made as I've gotten healthier. physically, mentally, emotionally healthier. And throughout my life, if anyone would have asked me at any time, Ken, are you trying to make choices or for your best interest? And I would have responded, yes, of course I am. And yet, one of the things that I kind of wondered about is that when I wasn't as healthy, I thought I was tuning in and listening and following that inner guidance, and yet time after time I was getting run into walls and just had a lot of negative things happen. And as I've gotten physically, mentally, emotionally healthier, it's been easier for me. I guess that I don't, can you comment at all? I don't know if that's just unique to me or if, because when you say trust your intuition, how much can our health level have an influence on our ability to really tune in? Are we hearing our intuition, or is it Aunt Martha talking to us?
The very, very, very good point indeed. How do people know that what they're listening to is actually their intuition? You know, what I said before about testing the spirit is what to do is to try it and to see if it works, and then what works is the intuition. What doesn't work isn't. What you stated about your physical health and your mental health is absolutely perfect, because it's the balance of the outer and the inner. You've got to have the inner mind, the inner temple, in perfect balance with the temple of the body. In 3 days Jesus will bring it down, as he says in the Bible. Or, the inner Christ will have to bring that temple down, because it's got to be remade. And at the end of the day, we're talking about manipulation, how man manipulates us, and how secret societies can be manipulative, and how the dark nature of man can control things. A great many of the physical ailments that we have created are created by man. They are not natural ailments. And so we need to, first of all, cut off the yoke of these things, get rid of them, and stop trusting all the things that we're being told. I'll give you an example. Something like last year, $13 trillion was spent on cancer research for something that is not even natural. Now, we are told it's a natural product, it's a natural thing that can kill us, and it isn't. It's caused by the foods and the chemicals that we are eating, and by the things that we are smoking and drinking, and by the stress levels that we are creating ourselves. There is a cure for cancer. There is a preventative cure for cancer. They will not tell us what it is, because there is too much money being made. And can you imagine how many jobs $13 trillion is keeping going? It is not in their interest for all the people to live a long time in an overcrowded world. So I do think that there is manipulation going off. I do think that we need to cut the shackles of the food that we are eating and that kind of manipulation to free up our own body. And whilst we're doing that, we will be freeing our mind too, because these foods also cause psychological issues, which is a much deeper subject.
And are there certain ones, or is it a large number of foods?
There's a huge number of foods. Most foods that you buy from a general supermarket are not necessarily good for you. There are things that we are told we shouldn't do, like eat the pips from an apple or the seed, because it's got cyanide in. And various other seeds from fruits which are taken out, and we just chuck them away. When you give an apple to a horse, does it spit the pips out? No, it doesn't. It eats the whole thing. And the fact is that recent research has shown that B17, for instance, which is found within these things, and small elements of cyanide, which is also found within these seeds, actually attack cancer cells and kill them. These are all concepts that are crushed by our wonderful people that are in power, who have lobbied by chemical companies, medical companies, people who are making all these so-called cures that they then charge us a fortune for. Do you know that there are certain drugs that they charge us for which cost something like 11 cents to make, and they charge the government $245
wow.
for an 11-cent product. So you can see the markup. Any retailer on the planet would kill for that. And I mean that most sincerely. They would
yeah.
kill for it, and they are doing. So the food element, there are so many poisons in our food. Our fruit, for instance, is grown to the point before it's actually ripe. So most of the goodness isn't even allowed to come out. It's taken off, it's refrigerated for 4 or 5 weeks, it's irradiated, it's, if it's not already been genetically modified, if it's not already been grown using all kinds of chemicals. These things are just cancer packets, and we're eating the poison that's being given to us, shortening our lives. We are genetically empowered to live at least 120 years, and those people, through their manipulation and however they've got into this state, are killing us. But the cure is there. Eat good, wholesome food. I'll give you another example. 50,000 years ago, man was travelling around the coasts, up rivers, around lakes. He was hunter-gathering. He hunted for 20% of the week. The rest of the week, he didn't have to do anything. He was perfectly healthy. He had excellent teeth, much better than any of those Tippex teeth people in Hollywood. He had wonderful bones. He didn't need plastic surgery. He lived a very good life and a long life. There is absolutely no evidence of warfare whatsoever until man stopped, stayed in one place, started dairy farming, eating more than 10% content of meat, stopped eating root foods as he was moving, interbred, and started killing each other over greed and jealousy and all the different kind of things that man does. You know, our past, our ancestors, weren't as bloody stupid as we think. They weren't clubbing each other over the head. They actually were a lot freer-minded and freer physically than we are today.
And that's when you're talking about the time of the hunter-gatherer?
Yes. Imagine this, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, hunter-gathering man didn't travel across land in great numbers because it was too dense. He followed the herds. He didn't stay in one place. There was copious amounts of food. He interbred, so there was no interbreeding. A good genetic mix-up was produced. He ate good food. He respected the earth. And it seems to be, anthropological evidence seems to show that man was really in an almost Eden state. And then he stopped. And now what do? We build these horrendous cities where we all live close together, buy guns and shoot each other.
Well, you've got to have a hobby.
Oh, yes. Now you're sounding like George Bush.
Oh. Maybe we could pick a better hobby, huh?
I have done, thank you.
Good. Yeah, I'm sure you do, Philip. Wow, this is this is some startling information. I know there's a movement. I don't know how much in England of people getting back into organically grown things or raw foods where it hasn't been cooked or processed, just to open up that pathway for better health.
Absolutely. It's kind of, in England, it's a bit of an undercurrent. The trouble with England is, England isn't what people used to kind of imagine. We're not like a biscuit tin picture anymore. England's got its own cancer, and it's called supermarkets. And they are trying to take over the country. Just local to me, you can imagine now, imagine a village with a cricket pitch. And on a Sunday, people play cricket, and it's beautiful, and it's nice and sunny. Tesco's want to buy the cricket pitch and build a supermarket and put a car park on there. Just around the corner, there's a 70-acre, beautiful farm that's been there for nearly 2,000 years since the Romans set it out. It has just been sold, and it will be now turned into an industrial estate. It will be concreted, and there will be thousands of cars and lorries and buildings, and it's just... This is what's encroaching the UK. This farm is being turned into a hub for supermarkets, which are killing all the local fruit and veg, all the butchers and the bakers, candlestick makers, all of those are going. You cannot find them anywhere anymore. We are all forced to go to supermarkets.
So going back to the village concept, my gosh, I would love to continue our conversation, and we've basically blazed through an hour of our time, Philip. I want to invite my listeners to go to www.gardenerswurld.com and feast upon the wondrous offerings that Philip has put together over the years, and perhaps can have you on again and to go into more of this. I know I'm going to be getting some more of your books and diving into them. And I just want to thank you for all the time and effort you've put into your research and helping us to find this important thing, build our strength, our knowledge, and our will, and from that to trust our intuition. Those are key items to help us live better. Thank you so much for sharing of your time and your wisdom.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
You're welcome. And to my listeners, tune in each and every Saturday for a wonderful new approach to helping you to live better and healthier. And here at advancedliving.com, we just want to thank you and tell your friends about BBS Radio so that they can partake of a lot of knowledge and information that's not readily available. I send forth and call forth a blessing of divine goodness upon all of us and trust that it is fulfilled as we've intended. And thank you again, Philip. God bless you and all my listeners. Until we meet again, thank you and goodbye for now. Let's go.